This is Audible.
Penguin Audio presents Danny the Champion of the World by Roald Dahl. Read by Peter Serafinowicz.
Chapter 1. The Filling Station. When I was 4 months old, my mother died suddenly, and my father was left to look after me all by himself. I had no brothers or sisters, so all through my boyhood, from the age of 4 months onward, there were just the two of us, my father and me. We lived in an old gypsy caravan behind a filling station. My father owned the filling station, and the caravan, and a small field behind. But that was about all he owned in the world. It was a very small filling station, on a small country road surrounded by fields and woody hills. While I was still a baby, my father washed me and fed me, and changed my nappies, and did all the millions of other things a mother normally does for her child. That is not an easy task for a man, especially when he has to earn his living at the same time, by repairing motor car engines and serving customers with petrol. But my father didn't seem to mind. I think that all the love he had felt for my mother when she was alive, he now lavished upon me. During my early years, I never had a moment's unhappiness or illness. I was now a scruffy little boy, with grease and oil all over me, but that was because I spent all day in the workshop helping my father with the cars. The filling station itself had only two pumps. There was a wooden shed behind the pumps that served as an office. There was nothing in the office except an old table and a cash register to put the money into. It was one of those where you pressed a button and a bell rang and the drawer shot out with a terrific bang. I used to love that. The square brick building to the right of the office was the workshop. My father built that himself with loving care, and it was the only really solid thing in the place. "We are engineers, you and I," he used to say to me. "We earn our living by repairing engines, and we can't do good work in a rotten workshop." It was a fine workshop, big enough to take one car comfortably and leave plenty of room round the sides for working. It had a telephone, so that customers could arrange to bring their cars in for repair. The caravan was our house and our home. It was a real old gypsy wagon with big wheels and fine patterns painted all over it in yellow and red and blue. My father said it was at least 150 years old. Many gypsy children, he said, had been born in it and had grown up within its wooden walls. With a horse to pull it, the old caravan must have wandered for thousands of miles along the roads and lanes of England. But now, its wanderings were over, and because the wooden spokes in the wheels were beginning to rot, my father had propped it up underneath with bricks. There was only one room in the caravan, and it wasn't much bigger than a fair-sized modern bathroom. It was a narrow room, the shape of the caravan itself, and against the back wall were two bunk beds, one above the other. The top one was my father's, the bottom one mine. Although we had electric lights in the workshop, we were not allowed to have them in the caravan. The electricity people said it was unsafe to put wires into something as old and rickety as that. So we got our heat and light in much the same way as the gypsies had done years ago. There was a wood-burning stove with a chimney that went up through the roof, and this kept us warm in winter. There was a paraffin burner on which to boil a kettle or cook a stew. And there was a paraffin lamp hanging from the ceiling. When I needed a bath, my father would heat a kettle of water and pour it into a basin. Then he would strip me naked and scrub me all over, standing up. This, I think, got me just as clean as if I were washed in a bath, probably cleaner because I didn't finish up sitting in my own dirty water. For furniture, we had two chairs and a small table, and those, apart from a tiny chest of drawers, were all the home comforts we possessed. They were all we needed. The lavatory was a funny little wooden hut standing in the field some way behind the caravan. It was fine in summertime, but I can tell you that sitting out there on a snowy day in winter was like sitting in a fridge. Immediately behind the caravan was an old apple tree. It bore lovely apples that ripened in the middle of September, and you could go on picking them for the next 4 or 5 weeks. Some of the boughs of the tree hung right over the caravan, and when the wind blew the apples down in the night, they often landed on our roof. I would hear them going, thump, 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 above my head as I lay in my bunk. But those noises never frightened me, because I knew exactly what was making them. I really loved living in that gypsy caravan. I loved it especially in the evenings, when I was tucked up in my bunk and my father was telling me stories. The paraffin lamp was turned low, and I could see lumps of wood glowing red-hot in the old stove. And wonderful it was to be lying there snug and warm in my bunk in that little room. Most wonderful of all was the feeling that when I went to sleep, my father would still be there, very close to me, sitting in his chair by the fire, or lying in the bunk above my own. Chapter 2. The Big Friendly Giant. My father, without the slightest doubt, was the most marvelous and exciting father any boy ever had. You might think, if you didn't know him well, that he was a stern and serious man. He wasn't. He was actually a wildly funny person. What made him appear so serious was the fact that he never smiled with his mouth. He did it all with his eyes. He had brilliant blue eyes, and when he thought of something funny, his eyes would flash, and if you looked carefully, you could actually see a tiny little golden spark dancing in the middle of each eye. But the mouth never moved. I was glad my father was an eye smiler. It meant he never gave me a fake smile, because it's impossible to make your eyes twinkle if you aren't feeling twinkly yourself. A mouth smile is different. You can fake a mouth smile any time you want, simply by moving your lips. I've also learned that a real mouth smile always has an eye smile to go with it. So watch out, I say, when someone smiles at you with his mouth, but the eyes stay the same. It's sure to be bogus. My father was not what you would call an educated man, and I doubt if he had read 20 books in his life. But he was a marvelous storyteller. He used to make up a bedtime story for me every single night, and the best ones were turned into serials and went on for many nights running. One of them, which must have gone on for at least 50 nights, was about an enormous fellow called the Big Friendly Giant, or the BFG for short. The BFG was 3 times as tall as an ordinary man, and his hands were as big as wheelbarrows. He lived in a vast underground cavern not far from our filling station, and he only came out into the open when it was dark. Inside the cavern, he had a powder factory where he made more than 100 different kinds of magic powder. Occasionally, as he told his stories, my father would stride up and down, waving his arms and waggling his fingers. But mostly, he would sit close to me on the edge of my bunk and speak very softly. The Big Friendly Giant makes his magic powders out of the dreams that children dream when they are asleep, he said. How? I asked. Tell me how, Dad. Dreams, my love, are very mysterious things. They float around in the night air like little clouds, searching for sleeping people. Can you see them? I asked. Nobody can see them. Then how does the Big Friendly Giant catch them?
Ah, my father said. That is the interesting part. A dream, you see,
as it goes drifting through the night air, makes a tiny little buzzing humming sound, a sound so soft and low it is impossible for ordinary people to hear it. But the BFG can hear it easily. His sense of hearing is absolutely fantastic. I loved the far, intent look on my father's face when he was telling a story. His face was pale and still and distant, unconscious of everything around him. "The BFG," he said, "can hear the tread of a ladybird's footsteps as she walks across a leaf. He can hear the whisperings of ants as they scurry around in the soil talking to one another. He can hear the sudden shrill cry of pain a tree gives out when a woodman cuts into it with an axe. Ah, yes, my darling, there is a whole world of sound around us that we cannot hear, because our ears are simply not sensitive enough." "What happens when he catches the dreams?" I asked. "He imprisons them in glass bottles and screws the tops down tight," my father said. "He has thousands of these bottles in his cave."
"Does he catch bad dreams as well as good ones?"
"Yes," my father said. "He catches both. But he only uses the good ones in his powders."
"What does he do with the bad ones?"
"He explodes them." It is impossible to tell you how much I loved my father. When he was sitting close to me on my bunk, I would reach out and slide my hand into his, and then he would fold his long fingers around my fist, holding it tight.
"What does the BFG do with his powders after he has made them?" I asked.
"In the dead of night," my father said, "he goes prowling through the villages, searching for houses where children are asleep. Because of his great height, he can reach windows that are one and even two flights up. And when he finds a room with a sleeping child, he opens his suitcase."
"His suitcase?" I said.
"The BFG always carries a suitcase and a blowpipe," my father said. "The blowpipe is as long as a lamppost. The suitcase is for the powders. So, he opens the suitcase and selects exactly the right powder, and he puts it into the blowpipe, and he slides the blowpipe in through the open window, and, poof, he blows in the powder, and the powder floats around the room. And the child breathes it in."
"And then what?" I asked.
"And then, Danny, the child begins to dream a marvelous and fantastic dream. And when the dream reaches its most marvelous and fantastic moment, then the magic powder really takes over. And suddenly, the dream is not a dream any longer, but a real happening. And the child is not asleep in bed. He is fully awake and is actually in the place of the dream and is taking part in the whole thing. I mean, really taking part in real life." More about that tomorrow. It's getting late. Good night, Danny. Go to sleep. My father kissed me, and then he turned down the wick of the little paraffin lamp until the flame went out. He seated himself in front of the wood stove, which now made a lovely red glow in the dark room.
"Dad,"
I whispered. "What is it?"
"Have you ever actually seen the big friendly giant?"
"Once," my father said. "Only once."
"You did? Where?"
"I was out behind the caravan," my father said. "And it was a clear moonlit night, and I happened to look up, and suddenly I saw this tremendous tall person running along the crest of the hill. He had a queer, long, striding, lolloping gait, and his black cloak was streaming out behind him like the wings of a bird. There was a big suitcase in one hand, and a blowpipe in the other. And when he came to the high hawthorn hedge at the end of the field, he just strode over it
as though it wasn't there.
Were you frightened, Dad?
No, my father said. It was thrilling to see him, and a little eerie, but I wasn't frightened. Go to sleep now. Good night. Chapter 3. Cars and Kites and Fire Balloons. My father was a fine mechanic. People who lived miles away used to bring their cars to him for repair, rather than take them to their nearest garage. He loved engines. "A petrol engine is sheer magic," he said to me once. "Just imagine being able to take 1,000 different bits of metal, and if you fit them all together in a certain way, and then if you feed them a little oil and petrol, and if you press a little switch, suddenly those bits of metal will all come to life, and they will purr and hum and roar. They will make the wheels of a motor car go whizzing round at fantastic speeds." It was inevitable that I too should fall in love with engines and cars. Don't forget that even before I could walk, the workshop had been my playroom. For where else could my father have put me so that he could keep an eye on me all day long? My toys were the greasy cogs and springs and pistons that lay around all over the place, and these, I can promise you, were far more fun to play with than most of the plastic stuff children are given these days. So, almost from birth, I began training to be a mechanic. But now that I was 5 years old, there was the problem of school to think about. It was the law that parents must send their children to school at the age of 5, and my father knew about this. We were in the workshop, I remember, on my 5th birthday, when the talk about school started. I was helping my father to fit new brake linings to the rear wheel of a big Ford, when suddenly he said to me, "You know something interesting, Danny? You must be easily the best 5-year-old mechanic in the world." This was the greatest compliment he had ever paid me. I was enormously pleased. "You like this work, don't you?" he said. "All this messing about with engines." "I absolutely love it," I said. He turned and faced me and laid a hand gently on my shoulder. "I want to teach you to be a great mechanic," he said. "And when you grow up, I hope you will become a famous designing engineer, a man who designs new and better engines for cars and aeroplanes. For that," he added, "you will need a really good education. But I don't want to send you to school quite yet. In another 2 years, you will have learned enough here with me to be able to take a small engine completely to pieces and put it together again all by yourself. After that, you can go to school." You probably think my father was crazy trying to teach a young child to be an expert mechanic. But as a matter of fact, he wasn't crazy at all. I learned fast, and I adored every moment of it. And, luckily for us, nobody came knocking on the door to ask why I wasn't attending school. So, 2 more years went by, and at the age of 7, believe it or not, I really could take a small engine to pieces and put it together again. I mean properly to pieces. Pistons and crankshaft and all. The time had come to start school. My school was in the nearest village, 2 miles away. We didn't have a car of our own. We couldn't afford one. But the walk took only 30 minutes, and I didn't mind that in the least. My father came with me. He insisted on coming. And when school ended at 4 p.m, he was always there waiting to walk me home. And so, life went on. The world I lived in consisted only of the filling station, the workshop, the caravan, the school, and, of course, the woods and fields and streams in the countryside around. But I was never bored. It was impossible to be bored in my father's company. He was too sparky a man for that. Plots and plans and new ideas came flying off him like sparks from a grindstone. "There's a good wind today," he said one Saturday morning. "Just right for flying a kite. Let's make a kite, Danny." So we made a kite. He showed me how to splice four thin sticks together in the shape of a star, with two more sticks across the middle to brace it. Then we cut up an old blue shirt of his and stretched the material across the framework of the kite. We added a long tail made of thread, with little leftover pieces of the shirt tied at intervals along it. We found a ball of string in the workshop, and he showed me how to attach the string to the framework so that the kite would be properly balanced in flight. Together, we walked to the top of the hill behind the filling station to release the kite. I found it hard to believe that this object, made only from a few sticks and a piece of old shirt, would actually fly. I held the string while my father held the kite, and the moment he let it go, it caught the wind and soared upward like a huge blue bird. "Let out some more, Danny," he cried. "Go on, as much as you like." Higher and higher soared the kite. Soon, it was just a small blue dot dancing in the sky miles above my head. And it was thrilling to stand there holding on to something that was so far away and so very much alive. This faraway thing was tugging and struggling on the end of the line like a big fish. "Let's walk it back to the caravan," my father said. So we walked down the hill again, with me holding the string and the kite still pulling fiercely on the other end. When we came to the caravan, we were careful not to get the string tangled in the apple tree, and we brought it all the way round to the front steps. "Tie it to the steps," my father said.
"Will it still stay up?" I asked.
"It will if the wind doesn't drop," he said. The wind didn't drop, and I will tell you something amazing. That kite stayed up there all through the night, and at breakfast time next morning, the small blue dot was still dancing and swooping in the sky. After breakfast, I hauled it down and hung it carefully against a wall in the workshop for another day. Not long after that, on a lovely still evening when there was no breath of wind anywhere, my father said to me, "This is just the right weather for a fire balloon."
"Let's make a fire balloon."
He must have planned this one beforehand, because he had already bought the four big sheets of tissue paper and the pot of glue from Mr. Witten's bookshop in the village. And now, using only the paper, the glue, a pair of scissors, and a piece of thin wire, he made me a huge, magnificent fire balloon in less than 15 minutes. In the opening at the bottom, he tied a ball of cotton wool, and we were ready to go. It was getting dark when we carried it outside into the field behind the caravan. We had with us a bottle of methylated spirit and some matches. I held the balloon upright while my father crouched underneath it and carefully poured a little meths onto the ball of cotton wool.
"Here goes," he said, putting a match to the cotton wool.
"Hold the sides out as much as you can, Danny."
A tall yellow flame leaped up from the ball of cotton wool and went right inside the balloon.
"It'll catch on fire," I cried.
"No, it won't," he said.
"Watch."
Between us, we held the sides of the balloon out as much as possible to keep them away from the flame in the early stages. But soon, the hot air filled the balloon, and the danger was over.
"She's nearly ready," my father said.
"Can you feel her floating?"
"Yes," I said. "Yes. Shall we let go?"
"Not yet. Wait a bit longer. Wait until she's tugging to fly away."
"She's tugging now," I said.
"Right," he cried. "Let her go!"
Slowly, majestically, and in absolute silence, our wonderful balloon began to rise up into the night sky.
"It flies!"
I shouted, clapping my hands and jumping about.
It flies! It flies!
My father was nearly as excited as I was.
It's a beauty, he said. This one's a real beauty. You never know how they're going to turn out until you fly them. Each one is different.
Up and up it went, rising very fast now in the cool night air. It was like a magic fireball in the sky. Will other people see it? I asked.
I'm sure they will, Danny. It's high enough now for them to see it for miles around.
What will they think it is, Dad?
A flying saucer, my father said. They'll probably call the police.
A small breeze had taken hold of the balloon and was carrying it away in the direction of the village.
Let's follow it, my father said, and with luck, we'll find it when it comes down.
We ran to the road. We ran along the road. We kept running.
She's coming down, my father shouted. The flame's nearly gone out.
We lost sight of it when the flame went out, but we guessed roughly which field it would be landing in, and we climbed over a gate and ran towards the place. For half an hour we searched the field in the darkness, but we couldn't find our balloon. The next morning, I went back alone to search again. I searched four big fields before I found it. It was lying in the corner of a field that was full of black and white cows. The cows were all standing around it and staring at it with their huge wet eyes. But they hadn't harmed it one bit. So I carried it home and hung it up alongside the kite against the wall in the workshop for another day.
You can fly the kite all by yourself any time you like, my father said. But you must never fly the fire balloon unless I'm with you. It's extremely dangerous.
All right, I said.
Promise me you'll never try to fly it alone, Danny.
I promise, I said.
Then there was the treehouse which we built high up in the top of the big oak at the bottom of our field.
And the bow and arrow. The bow, a 4-foot-long ash sapling, and the arrows flighted with the tail feathers of partridge and pheasant. And stilts that made me 10 feet tall. And a boomerang that came back and fell at my feet nearly every time I threw it.
And, for my last birthday, there had been something that was more fun, perhaps, than all the rest. For 2 days before my birthday, I'd been forbidden to enter the workshop because my father was in there working on a secret. And, on the birthday morning, out came an amazing machine made from 4 bicycle wheels and several large soap boxes. But this was no ordinary whizzer. It had a brake pedal, a steering wheel, a comfortable seat, and a strong front bumper to take the shock of a crash. I called it Sopo, and just about every day I would take it up to the top of the hill in the field behind the filling station and come shooting down again at incredible speeds, riding it like a bronco over the bumps. So, you can see that being 8 years old and living with my father was a lot of fun. But I was impatient to be 9. I reckoned that being 9 would be even more fun than being 8. As it turned out, I was not altogether right about this. My 9th year was certainly more exciting than any of the others, but not all of it was exactly what you would call fun.
Chapter 4. My Father's Deep, Dark Secret. Here I am at the age of 9, just before all the excitement started, and I didn't have a worry in the world. You will learn as you get older, just as I learned that autumn, that no father is perfect. Grown-ups are complicated creatures, full of quirks and secrets. Some have quirkier quirks and deeper secrets than others, but all of them, including one's own parents, have 2 or 3 private habits hidden up their sleeves that would probably make you gasp if you knew about them. The rest of this book
is about a most private and secret habit my father had, and about the strange adventures it led us both into. It all started on a Saturday evening. It was the first Saturday of September. Around 6 o'clock, my father and I had supper together in the caravan as usual. Then I went to bed. My father told me a fine story and kissed me good night. I fell asleep. For some reason, I woke up again during the night. I lay still, listening for the sound of my father's breathing in the bunk above mine. I could hear nothing. He wasn't there. I was certain of that. This meant that he had gone back to the workshop to finish a job. He often did that after he had tucked me in. I listened for the usual workshop sounds, the little clinking noises of metal against metal, or the tap of a hammer. They always comforted me tremendously, those noises in the night, because they told me my father was close at hand. But on this night, no sound came from the workshop. The filling station was silent. I got out of my bunk and found a box of matches by the sink. I struck one and held it up to the funny old clock that hung on the wall above the kettle. It said 11:10. I went to the door of the caravan.
"Dad," I said softly. "Dad, are you there?"
No answer. There was a small wooden platform outside the caravan door, about 4 feet above the ground. I stood on the platform and gazed around me.
"Dad," I called out, "where are you?"
Still no answer. In pajamas and bare feet, I went down the caravan steps and crossed over to the workshop. I switched on the light. The old car we had been working on through the day was still there, but not my father. I have already told you he did not have a car of his own, so there was no question of his having gone for a drive. He wouldn't have done that anyway. I was sure he would never willingly have left me alone in the filling station at night. In which case, I thought, he must have fainted suddenly from some awful illness, or fallen down and banged his head. I would need a light if I was going to find him. I took the torch from the bench in the workshop. I looked in the office. I went around and searched behind the office and behind the workshop. I ran down the field to the lavatory. It was empty.
"Dad!" I shouted into the darkness. "Dad! Where are you?"
I ran back to the caravan. I shone the light into his bunk to make absolutely sure he wasn't there. He wasn't in his bunk. I stood in the dark caravan, and for the first time in my life, I felt a touch of panic. The filling station was a long way from the nearest farmhouse. I took the blanket from my bunk and put it round my shoulders. Then I went out the caravan door and sat on the platform with my feet on the top step of the ladder. There was a new moon in the sky, and across the road the big field lay pale and deserted in the moonlight. The silence was deathly. I don't know how long I sat there. It may have been 1 hour. It could have been 2. But I never dozed off. I wanted to keep listening all the time. If I listened very carefully, I might hear something that would tell me where he was. Then, at last, from far away, I heard the faint tap-tap of footsteps on the road. The footsteps were coming closer and closer. Tap, 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 tap. Was it him? Or was it somebody else? I sat still, watching the road. I couldn't see very far along it. It faded away into a misty moonlit darkness. Tap, tap, tap. Tap, came the footsteps. Then, out of the mist, a figure appeared. It was him. I jumped down the steps and ran onto the road to meet him.
"Danny," he cried, "what on earth's the matter?"
"I thought something awful had happened to you," I said. He took my hand in his and walked me back to the caravan in silence. Then he tucked me into my bunk. "I'm so sorry," he said. "I should never have done it. But you don't usually wake up, do you?"
"Where did you go, Dad?"
"You must be tired out," he said.
"I'm not a bit tired. Couldn't we light the lamp for a little while?"
My father put a match to the wick of the lamp hanging from the ceiling, and the little yellow flame sprang up and filled the inside of the caravan with pale light. "How about a hot drink?" he said.
"Yes, please."
He lit the paraffin burner and put the kettle on to boil. "I have decided something," he said. "I am going to let you in on the deepest, darkest secret of my whole life." I was sitting up in my bunk, watching my father. "You asked me where I had been," he said. "The truth is, I was up in Hazel's Wood."
"Hazel's Wood?" I cried. "That's miles away."
6 miles and a half, my father said. "I know I shouldn't have gone, and I'm very, very sorry about it. But I had such a powerful yearning." His voice trailed away into nothingness.
"But why would you want to go all the way up to Hazel's Wood?" I asked.
He spooned cocoa powder and sugar into 2 mugs, doing it very slowly and leveling each spoonful as though he were measuring medicine. "Do you know what is meant by poaching?" he asked.
"Poaching? Not really, no."
"It means going up into the woods in the dead of night and coming back with something for the pot. Poachers in other places poach all sorts of different things, but around here it's always pheasants."
"You mean stealing them?" I said, aghast.
"We don't look at it that way," my father said. "Poaching is an art. A great poacher is a great artist."
"Is that actually what you were doing in Hazel's Wood, Dad? Poaching pheasants?"
"I was practicing the art," he said. "The art of poaching." I was shocked.
My own father, a thief. This gentle, lovely man. I couldn't believe he would go creeping into the woods at night to pinch valuable birds belonging to somebody else. "The kettle's boiling," I said.
"Ah, so it is." He poured the water into the mugs and brought mine over to me. Then he fetched his own and sat with it at the end of my bunk. "Your granddad," he said, "my own dad, was a magnificent and splendiferous poacher. It was he who taught me all about it. I caught the poaching fever from him when I was 10 years old, and I've never lost it since. Mind you, in those days, just about every man in our village was out in the woods at night poaching pheasants, and they did it not only because they loved the sport, but because they needed food for their families. When I was a boy, times were bad for a lot of people in England. There was very little work to be had anywhere, and some families were literally starving. Yet, a few miles away, in the rich man's wood, thousands of pheasants were being fed like kings twice a day. So, can you blame my dad for going out occasionally and coming home with a bird or two for the family to eat?"
"No," I said, "of course not. But we're not starving here, Dad."
"You've missed the point, Danny boy. You've missed the whole point. Poaching is such a fabulous and exciting sport that once you start doing it, it gets into your blood, and you can't give it up. Just imagine," he said, leaping off the bunk and waving his mug in the air. "Just imagine for a minute that you are all alone up there in the dark wood, and the wood is full of keepers hiding behind the trees, and the keepers have guns."
"Guns?" I gasped. "They don't have guns."
"All keepers have guns, Danny.
It's for the vermin mostly, the foxes and stoats and weasels who go after the pheasants. But they'll always take a pot at a poacher too, if they spot him.
Dad, you're joking.
Not at all. But they only do it from behind, only when you're trying to escape. They like to pepper you in the legs at about 50 yards.
They can't do that, I cried. They could go to prison for shooting someone.
You could go to prison for poaching, my father said. There was a glint and a sparkle in his eyes now that I'd never seen before. Many's the night when I was a boy, Danny, I've gone into the kitchen and seen my old dad lying face down on the table, and Mum standing over him, digging the gunshot pellets out of his backside with a potato knife.
It's not true,
I said, starting to laugh. You don't believe me?
Yes, I believe you.
Towards the end, he was so covered in tiny little white scars, he looked exactly like it was snowing.
I don't know why I'm laughing, I said. It's not funny. It's horrible.
Poacher's Bottom, they used to call it, my father said. And there wasn't a man in the whole village who didn't have a bit of it one way or another. But my dad was the champion.
How's the cocoa? Fine, thank you.
If you're hungry, we could have a midnight feast, he said.
Could we, Dad?
Of course. My father got out the bread tin and the butter and cheese and started making sandwiches. Let me tell you about this phony pheasant shooting business, he said. First of all, it is practiced only by the rich. Only the very rich can afford to rear pheasants just for the fun of shooting them down when they grow up. These wealthy idiots spend huge sums of money every year buying baby pheasants from pheasant farms and rearing them in pens until they're big enough to be put out into the woods. In the woods, the young birds hang around like flocks of chickens. They're guarded by keepers and fed twice a day on the best corn until they're so fat they can hardly fly. Then, beaters are hired, who walk through the woods clapping their hands and making as much noise as they can to drive the half-tame pheasants towards the half-baked men and their guns. After that, it's bang, 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 and down they come. Would you like strawberry jam on one of these?
Yes, please, I said. One jam and one cheese. But, Dad...
What?
How do you actually catch the pheasants when you're poaching? Do you have a gun hidden away up there?
A gun? He cried, disgusted. Real poachers don't shoot pheasants, Danny. Didn't you know that? You've only got to fire a cap pistol up in those woods, and the keepers will be on you.
Then how do you do it?
Ah, my father said, and the eyelids drooped over the eyes, veiled and secretive. He spread strawberry jam thickly on a piece of bread, taking his time. These things are big secrets, he said. Very big secrets indeed. But I reckon if my father could tell them to me, then maybe I can tell them to you. Would you like me to do that?
Yes, I said. Tell me now.
Chapter 5. The Secret Methods. All the best ways of poaching pheasants were discovered by my old dad, my father said. My old dad studied poaching the way a scientist studies science. My father put my sandwiches on a plate and brought them over to my bunk. I put the plate on my lap and started eating. I was ravenous. Do you know? My old dad actually used to keep a flock of prime roosters in the backyard, just to practice on, my father said. A rooster is very much like a pheasant, you see. They are equally stupid, and they like the same sorts of food. A rooster is tamer, that's all. So, whenever my dad thought up a new method of catching pheasants, he tried it out on a rooster first, to see if it worked.
What are the best ways?
I asked.
My father laid a half-eaten sandwich on the edge of the sink and gazed at me in silence for about 20 seconds.
Promise you won't tell another soul.
I promise.
Now here's the thing, he said. Here's the first big secret.
Ah,
but it's more than a secret, Danny. It's the most important discovery in the whole history of poaching.
He edged a shade closer to me. His face was pale in the pale yellow glow from the lamp in the ceiling, but his eyes were shining like stars.
So, here it is, he said, and now suddenly his voice became soft and whispery and very private. Pheasants, he whispered, are crazy about raisins.
Is that the big secret?
That's it, he said. It may not sound very much when I say it like that, but believe me, it is.
Raisins, I said.
Just ordinary raisins.
It's like a mania with them.
You throw a few raisins into a bunch of pheasants, and they'll start fighting each other to get at them. My dad discovered that 40 years ago, just as he discovered these other things I'm about to describe to you.
My father paused and glanced over his shoulder, as though to make sure there was nobody at the door of the caravan listening.
Method number one, he said softly, is known as the horsehair stopper.
The horsehair stopper,
I murmured. That's it, my father said. And the reason it's such a brilliant method is that it's completely silent. There's no squawking or flapping around or anything else with the horsehair stopper when the pheasant is caught. And that's mighty important, because don't forget, Danny, when you're up in those woods at night and the great trees are spreading their branches high above you like black ghosts, it is so silent you can hear a mouse moving. And somewhere among it all, the keepers are waiting and listening. They're always there, those keepers, standing stony still against a tree or behind a bush with their guns at the ready.
What happens with the horsehair stopper? I asked. How does it work?
It's very simple, he said. First, you take a few raisins, and you soak them in water overnight to make them plump and soft and juicy. Then you get a bit of good stiff horsehair, and you cut it up into half-inch lengths.
Horsehair, I said. Where do you get horsehair?
You pull it out of a horse's tail, of course. That's not difficult, as long as you stand to one side when you're doing it so you don't get kicked.
Go on, I said.
So, you cut the horsehair up into half-inch lengths. Then you push one of these lengths through the middle of a raisin so there's just a tiny bit of horsehair sticking out on each side. That's all you do. You are now ready to catch a pheasant. If you want to catch more than one, you prepare more raisins. Then, when evening comes, you creep up into the woods, making sure you get there before the pheasants have gone up into the trees to roost. Then you scatter the raisins, and soon along comes a pheasant and gobbles it up.
What happens then? I asked.
Here's what my dad discovered, he said. First of all, the horsehair makes the raisin stick in the pheasant's throat. It doesn't hurt him. It simply stays there and tickles. It's rather like having a crumb stuck in your own throat. But after that, believe it or not, the pheasant never moves his feet again. He becomes absolutely rooted to the spot, and there he stands, pumping his silly neck up and down just like a piston. And all you've got to do is nip out quickly from the place where you're hiding and pick him up.
Is that really true, Dad?
I swear it, my father said. Once a pheasant's had the horsehair stopper, you can turn a hosepipe on him and he won't move. It's just one of those unexplainable little things. But it takes a genius to discover it.
My father paused, and there was a gleam of pride in his eyes as he dwelt for a moment upon the memory of his own dad.
the great poaching inventor. "So, that's method number one," he said.
"What's number two?" I asked.
"Ah," he said, "number two's a real beauty. It's a flash of pure brilliance. I can even remember the day it was invented. I was just about the same age as you are now, and it was a Sunday morning, and my dad comes into the kitchen holding a huge white rooster in his hands. 'I think I've got it,' he says. There's a little smile on his face, and a shine of glory in his eyes, and he comes in very soft and quick and puts the bird down right in the middle of the kitchen table. 'By golly,' he says, 'I've got a good one this time.'
'A good what?'
Mum says, looking up from the sink.
'Horace, take that filthy bird off my table.'
The rooster has a funny little paper hat over its head, like an ice cream cone upside down, and my dad is pointing to it proudly and saying, 'Stroke him. Go on, stroke him. Do anything you like to him. He won't move an inch.' The rooster starts scratching away at the paper hat with one of its feet, but the hat seems to be stuck on and it won't come off.
'No bird in the world is going to run away once you cover up its eyes,' my dad says, and he starts poking the rooster with his finger and pushing it around on the table. The rooster doesn't take the slightest bit of notice. 'You can have this one,' he says to Mum. 'You can have it and wring its neck and dish it up for dinner as a celebration of what I have just invented.' And then straight away he takes me by the arm and marches me quickly out of the door, and off we go over the fields and up into the big forest over the other side of Little Hampton, which used to belong to the Duke of Buckingham. And in less than 2 hours we get 5 lovely fat pheasants with no more trouble than it takes to go out and buy them in a shop."
My father paused for breath. His eyes were shining bright as they gazed back into the wonderful world of his youth.
"But, Dad," I said, "how do you get the paper hats over the pheasants' heads?"
"You'd never guess it, Danny."
"Tell me."
"Listen carefully," he said, glancing again over his shoulder, as though he expected to see a keeper or even the Duke of Buckingham himself at the caravan door. "Here's how you do it. First of all, you dig a little hole in the ground. Then you twist a piece of paper into the shape of a cone, and you fit this into the hole, hollow end up, like a cup. Then you smear the inside of the paper cup with glue and drop in a few raisins. At the same time, you lay a trail of raisins along the ground leading up to it. Now the old pheasant comes pecking along the trail, and when he gets to the hole, he pops his head inside to gobble up the raisins, and the next thing he knows, he's got a paper hat stuck over his eyes, and he can't see a thing. Isn't that a fantastic idea, Danny? My dad called it the sticky hat."
"Is that the one you used this evening?" I asked.
My father nodded.
"How many did you get, Dad?"
"Well," he said, looking a bit sheepish, "actually, I didn't get any. I arrived too late. By the time I got there, they were already going up to roost. That shows you how out of practice I am."
"Was it fun all the same?"
"Marvelous," he said. "Absolutely marvelous.
Just like the old days."
He undressed and put on his pajamas. Then he turned out the lamp in the ceiling and climbed up into his bunk.
"Dad," I whispered.
"What is it?"
"Have you been doing this often after I've gone to sleep, without me knowing it?"
"No," he said. "Tonight was the first time for 9 years. When your mother died, and I had to look after you by myself, I made a vow to give up poaching until you were old enough to be left alone at nights. But this evening, I broke my vow. I had such a tremendous longing to go up into the woods again. I just couldn't stop myself. I'm very sorry I did it."
"If you ever want to go again, I won't mind," I said.
"Do you mean that?" he said, his voice rising in excitement. "Do you really mean it?"
"Yes," I said, "so long as you tell me beforehand.
You will promise to tell me beforehand if you're going, won't you? You're quite sure you won't mind?
Quite sure.
Good boy, he said. And we'll have roast pheasant for supper whenever you want it. It's miles better than chicken.
And one day, Dad, will you take me with you?
Aha, he said. I reckon you're just a bit young to be dodging around up there in the dark. I wouldn't want you to get peppered with buckshot in the backside at your age.
Your dad took you at my age, I said.
There was a short silence. We'll see how it goes, my father said. But I'd like to get back into practice before I make any promises. You understand?
Yes, I said.
I wouldn't want to take you with me until I'm right back in my old form.
No, I said.
Good night, Danny. Go to sleep now.
Good night, Dad.
Chapter 6. Mr. Victor Hazel. The following Friday, while we were having supper in the caravan, my father said,
If it's all right with you, Danny, I'll be going out again tomorrow night.
You mean poaching?
Yes.
Will it be Hazel's Wood again?
It'll always be Hazel's Wood, he said. First, because that's where all the pheasants are. And second, because I don't like Mr. Hazel one little bit, and it's a pleasure to poach his birds.
I must pause here to tell you something about Mr. Victor Hazel. He was a brewer of beer, and he owned a huge brewery. He was rich beyond words, and his property stretched for miles along either side of the valley. All the land around us belonged to him, everything on both sides of the road, everything except the small patch of ground on which our filling station stood. That patch belonged to my father. It was a little island in the middle of the vast ocean of Mr. Hazel's estate. Mr. Victor Hazel was a roaring snob, and he tried desperately to get in with what he believed were the right kind of people. He hunted with the hounds and gave shooting parties and wore fancy waistcoats. Every weekday, he drove his enormous silver Rolls-Royce past our filling station on his way to the brewery. As he flashed by, we would sometimes catch a glimpse of the great, glistening, beery face above the wheel, pink as a ham, all soft and inflamed from drinking too much beer.
No, my father said, I do not like Mr. Victor Hazel one little bit. I haven't forgotten the way he spoke to you last year when he came in for a fill-up.
I hadn't forgotten it either. Mr. Hazel had pulled up alongside the pumps in his glistening, gleaming Rolls-Royce and had said to me,
Fill her up and look sharp about it.
I was 8 years old at the time. He didn't get out of the car. He just handed me the key to the cap of the petrol tank. And, as he did so, he barked out,
And keep your filthy little hands to yourself. Do you understand?
I didn't understand at all. So I said, What do you mean, sir? There was a leather riding crop on the seat beside him. He picked it up and pointed it at me like a pistol.
If you make any dirty finger marks on my paintwork, he said, I'll step right out of this car and give you a good hiding.
My father was out of the workshop almost before Mr. Hazel had finished speaking. He strode up to the window of the car and placed his hands on the sill and leaned in.
I don't like you speaking to my son like that, he said. His voice was dangerously soft.
Mr. Hazel did not look at him. He sat quite still in the seat of his Rolls-Royce, his tiny piggy eyes staring straight ahead. There was a smug, superior little smile around the corners of his mouth.
You had no reason to threaten him, my father went on. He had done nothing wrong.
Mr. Hazel continued to act as though my father wasn't there.
Next time you threaten someone with a good hiding, I suggest
You pick on a person your own size, my father said. Like me, for instance. Mr. Hazel still did not move. Now, go away, please, my father said.